Well, friends, today we come to the last of our series of sermons on this Old Testament book of Ezra. And what a journey it's been over these past 10 or so weeks. As my long-suffering wife said to me last night, phew, we've almost made it. Well, we almost have, so let's go. We began about 10 weeks ago with the story of a story begins in Persia. Remember, we read there that the Lord moved the heart of a pagan king, King Cyrus, and caused him to allow God's people, who'd been exiled for their wickedness and judgment, he caused King Cyrus's heart to be moved and to issue a decree and saying, let those people go back to their homeland. And then we saw how the exiles, now back in their homeland, began to rebuild their nation under the leadership of Jeshua and Zerubbabel. And right from the start, they began to rebuild the temple as the centre of their worship for God. Then in chapter 7, our hero appeared, Ezra. He came onto the scene. And over these past few weeks, we've begun to see how Ezra taught the people God's law. They needed not only a temple to rebuild their nation, they needed God's law for their nation. And he began to seek to address questions such as, what does it mean for us to be the people of God after all these events of the exile? Was God's plan for us still to be a light to the Gentiles? And most importantly, how was God's faithfulness to us as shown by our return, how is that to be reflected in our lives of faithfulness back to God? So we've covered a lot over these 10 or so weeks under this big theme, rebuilding a nation. But now we come to this final chapter in the book of Ezra, and what a difficult chapter it is. Why is it difficult? Firstly, Ezra's call to the Israelites to divorce their pagan wives just doesn't fit in with our modern age of tolerance for all people, no matter what their sex, race, or religion. It sounds harsh, it sounds unfair, and it sounds bigoted. No wonder that one commentator I read describes it as amongst the least attractive parts of Ezra, and indeed the whole of the Old Testament. But secondly, it's difficult also for us in a more personal way. For it reminds us as God's people that in order for us to be obedient to God, tough choices often need to be made. And haven't we seen that all too clearly in our newspapers this week? The world's most powerful man, publicly humiliated because of his unwillingness to make such tough choices in his own private life. A graphic portrayal of the truth that sin always has terrible and tragic consequences. Pain, hurt, and confusion, for not just for family and friends, but for a nation as a whole. The tragedy of sin, the need to make tough choices in our lives. Now, we may not be like Ezra, involved in the rebuilding of a broken nation, but we are all as Christians involved in the business of rebuilding broken lives. Firstly, our own broken and sinful lives. Of course, not one of us is here today thinking that we, above all this, all of us, have committed sin before God. All of us need to be on guard about it. We need to rebuild our lives when they break. But secondly, we also need to be ministering to the broken lives of other people. God calls us as Christians to do that. And this passage, I hope, will help us in these tasks, rebuilding our own lives if they're broken, rebuilding the lives of others. Well, let's begin to look at our passage. We begin with verses 1 to 4, the call to take courage. Look at those verses. Pardon me. Now, before I look at the verses, let me just say this. Being a leader in today's modern world is no easy matter. And when I use the word leader, I mean it in its broader sense. Someone who is responsible for other people, to guide them, direct them, and teach them. As a parent, for example, having to decide about your children's education, as my wife and I have had to do over these past few weeks, is not an easy thing to do. Lots of questions and at times very few answers. And equally so if you're in the world of business or finance, the hard decisions you have to make. Who will we promote in the company? Or the difficulty of knowing you have to tell someone at work that their services are no longer required. It's not easy being a leader. It requires much prayer, the support and advice of others, and not a small dose of courage. And as we look at these early verses of chapter 10, we'll see this is exactly what Ezra needs as he faces the task of helping this nation rebuild itself. Look what he does in verse 1. He prays. While Ezra was praying and confessing, weeping and throwing himself down before the house of God, a large crowd of Israelites, men, women and children, gathered around him. Ezra has just heard the news that his people, this people he'd been called to lead, God's holy nation, were in danger of committing the most terrible apostasy. Like their forefathers before them, they'd taken for themselves wives from the surrounding pagan nations, and so were in danger of slipping into idolatry themselves and facing God's judgment upon their own heads. And Ezra does the only thing that he can possibly do in this situation. He knows there's nothing he can do to change their hearts. All he can do is ask God to do that for them. And what sort of prayers is he praying here? Not just any old prayers, but the deepest prayers you can imagine, for here is a man who loves his people. So he's praying and confessing their sins on their behalf. His prayers flow into tears. He throws himself down in agony for his people. Here is a man who is praying serious prayers, for his people are facing a serious crisis. Charles Spurgeon once said this about the importance of prayer. He said, "Prayer pulls the rope down below, and the great bell rings above in the ears of God. Some scarcely ring the bell, for they pray so sluggishly. Others give only the occasional jerk at the rope. But he who communicates with heaven is the man who grasps the rope boldly and pulls continuously with all his might." This is what Ezra needed to do here, and those of us in Christian leadership responsible for other people, this is what we need to do constantly and continuously. So we see here Ezra firstly prays. Secondly, in verse 2, we see that Ezra listens to the advice of others. We read, "Then Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the descendants of Elam, spoke to Ezra." It seems that Ezra's prayers were immediately answered, and the people began to respond. At the end of verse 1, they too wept bitterly, as well as Ezra weeping bitterly. And above the noise of the weeping comes the voice of Shechaniah, this unknown person. We don't know anything else about him apart from these verses. Out comes his voice calling Ezra to take courage and to lead the people to put right their wrongdoings. And Ezra listens to the words of this man in the midst of his own despair. Now note the two things that Shechaniah says to Ezra. Firstly, he outlines to Ezra the problem, and then he shows Ezra the only solution. So firstly, the problem, back to verse 2, Shechaniah said to Ezra, "We have been unfaithful to our God." That's it. We've been unfaithful to God. See, this man recognises that the basis of the people's sin is not so much that they've broken the law of God, but they've broken their relationship with God. They've broken faith with their faithful God. And friends, isn't this in reality what sin actually is? It's not so much law breaking, but law making. It's about we human beings thinking that we know better than God. We make up our own rules about how we think life works, and then we live it without reference to Him. Recently, I enjoyed rereading C.S. Lewis's science fiction book, Out of the Silent Planet. And it's a great book. I'd recommend it as a good read. Lots of twists and turns and things to make you think. But one part of it struck me in particular. The hero, Dr. Ransom, has gone to the planet Mars and, having learnt to communicate with one of the Martian races, who are called Sorns, he begins to try to explain to them about the people who live back on Earth. And Lewis writes this: Ransom decided from the outset that he would be quite frank and that it would be unavailing to do otherwise. They were astonished at what he had to tell them of human history, of wars, slavery, and prostitution. "It's because they have no God," said one of the younger Sorns. "No," said an older and wiser Sorn, "it's because every one of them wants to be a little God himself. They cannot help it. There must be some rule, but how can creatures rule themselves? It's like someone trying to lift themselves by their own hair, or like someone trying to see over the whole country when they're on the same level as the country. It's like a female trying to beget young by herself. It is surely impossible." See, Shechaniah recognises the problem of his people. They wanted simply to rule themselves. The temple may have been built in the centre of their city, but they did not allow God to be in the centre of their lives. And as one of my colleagues is fond to say, the problem with people who want to push God off the throne is that the retirement prospects for such people are not good. God is the judge. And as we read in the Bible, one day, if that's us, every knee shall bow to him. So Shechaniah says the problem. He speaks it as it is. We have sinned. We have been unfaithful. But then he points Ezra, in Ezra's despair, to the future. He shows the promise and the way ahead. Second half of verse 2. The big word, but. It's a great word. He says, "But in spite of this, Ezra, there is still hope for Israel. Now let us make a covenant before our God to send away these women and their children in accordance with the counsel of my Lord and of those who fear the commands of our God. Let it be done according to the law. Ezra, rise up. This matter's in your hands. We will support you. Take courage and do it." It's a hard thing being a leader. And like Ezra, if that's us, we need to be people of prayer, people who listen to the advice of others, and as we will see in a moment in the next section, people of courage. So let's look at our next section, which I've called A Call to Decide, verses 5 to 11. Now, I wonder if you've heard the somewhat apocryphal story of the people on a well-known passenger ship travelling from Australia to England, who, whilst enjoying the freedom of sailing in the open seas, suddenly heard the ship's loudspeakers go on and the captain's voice come across in a clear, even tone. "There's no cause for alarm, But we felt that you passengers should know that for the past 3 days, we've been experiencing some difficulties on the ship. The radio compass has gone down, we have no radar, and due to a breakdown of some key components, the navigational system is no longer working. This means that in the broad sense, we're lost. We're not exactly sure where we're heading. And then there was a pause, and then seeming to recognise that some passengers might be panicking, the captain added, "But I'm sure you'll be glad to know that in spite of all this, we're still making very good time." Now, whether that was really true of that particular ship, I'm not sure. But it's certainly true of most people. The journey seems to be going well, but they're not sure what direction they're meant to be heading in. But this is not the case for Ezra. This was not the case for God's people then, and it's not the case for God's people now. We do know the way in which we're meant to walk. The problem is, we just don't want to go there half the time. So Ezra here takes action to help God's people do what is right. Look what he does there in verse 5. We read, "So Ezra rose up, he put the leading priests and Levites and all Israel under an oath to do what had been suggested, and they took the oath." That is, they're hot on for this decision. So he strikes while the iron's hot, and he tells them, "Put your money where your mouth is. Take an oath. Let's take some action." Secondly, verse 6, we read, Ezra continues to pray. He withdrew from before the house of God and went to the room of Johanan, the son of Eliashib. And while he was there, he ate no food and drank no water, for he continued to mourn over the unfaithfulness of the exiles. He knew, you see, he still needed help in this matter. It wasn't a foregone conclusion what would happen. So he prayed and he fasted. And then he called an assembly. Verse 7, a proclamation was then issued throughout Judah and Jerusalem for all the exiles to assemble in Jerusalem. Anyone who failed to appear within 3 days would forfeit his property in accordance with the decision of the officials and elders, and would themselves be expelled from the assembly of the exiles. Now, this assembly was no ordinary affair. First of all, it was a somber assembly. In verse 9 we read, "Within the 3 days, all the men of Judah and Benjamin had gathered in Jerusalem, and on the 20th day of the 9th month, all the people were sitting in the square before the house of God, happy? No. Greatly distressed by the occasion and because of the rain." Well, normally when the people of God came to the temple, they were in great joy. It was their festival. They loved going to the temple. But today they came in great seriousness, for they knew it was time for them to do business with God. It's interesting to read one commentator's note on the weather report. He says, "When they wept, the heavens wept too." Here's a vivid reminder to them, in terms of the rain, of God's displeasure at the sin they had tolerated in their community. So it was a somber assembly. Secondly, it was a public assembly. Look back at verse 8, we read, "A proclamation was issued for all the exiles to assemble in Jerusalem." Sin is rarely a private thing. It always affects others. And because this was a situation which everybody knew about, it affected the whole community. It needed dealing with publicly. Now, we don't see here a model for us to call regular church meetings to discipline fellow Christians who sin against us. Jesus says, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone." But there are situations where such assemblies of God's people to bring discipline to the church need to occur. Where a sin has occurred in the church, and the biggest scandal is not so much the sin itself, but the fact that no one seems to be doing anything about it. And for the sake of the integrity of the gospel, that which is right must not actually be done, it must also be seen to be done, else it will be a scandal. So it was a somber assembly, a public assembly, and thirdly, it was a decisive assembly. And this is where the rubber hits the road. Here we come to the difficult decision that the people were called to make. They'd shown their recognition of sin, they recognised their unfaithfulness, and now Ezra calls them to do something about it. And the call that he gave them was not an easy call. It was tough. And as we look at these verses, remember this. The issue is not racism that he's addressing, but simply idolatry and the purity of religion. Look at verses 10 to 11. Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, "You have been unfaithful. You have married foreign women, adding to Israel's guilt. Now make confession to the Lord, the God of your fathers, and do his will. Separate yourselves from the peoples around you and from your foreign wives." Now, friends, divorce is always hateful to God. We read that in Malachi chapter 2, verse 16. And Jesus himself tells us in Mark chapter 10, verse 5, that divorce is only ever a witness to our human hardness of heart. And for us today, such a reason for divorce as Ezra gives here is not an option. The Apostle Paul tells us so in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 12. "If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her." And same for a brother, for a sister who has a husband who is not a believer. If we are married to somebody who is not a Christian, our calling is not to seek to separate from them, but to do as the Apostle Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 3, to win them over without words when they see the purity and reverence of our lives. But if that's the case now, it was not the case in Ezra's day. Israel's calling was to be a servant community, a light to the nations, a blessing to the world. And that particular calling could only be maintained if the people as a whole were willing to heed God's call to radical obedience and purity of lifestyle. And so what Ezra's calling them to do here is the lesser of two evils. As one writer helpfully puts it, "The unhappiness caused by these broken homes must be set not only against the initial transgression involved in the contracting of the marriages, that is, they broke God's law in the first place, but also set against the ultimate blessing to the world that would come only through a purified community. Israel needed to remain a distinct community so that the promises relating to the Messiah would be fulfilled. The advent of our Saviour hinged on the obedience of Ezra and the people of God." So the call to take courage, the call to decide, and thirdly, the call to investigate clearly, verses 12 to 44. Now note two things in these verses. Firstly, an encouragement, verses 12 and then 16 and 17. The encouragement, verse 12, "The whole assembly responded with a loud voice, 'Ezra, you are right. We must do as you say.'" And then down to 16 and 17, where after some delays we read, "So the exiles did as was proposed. Ezra the priest selected men who had family heads, one from each family division, and all of them designated by name. And on the first day of the 10th month, they sat down to investigate the cases, and by the first day of the first month, they finished dealing with all the men who had married foreign women. So here we see the good news. God's people are taking on board Ezra's challenge and beginning the long, slow work of rebuilding their community. And Ezra's commission took 3 months, and they found a substantial number of people, 110 men, you can count them up yourself. And as we see in verse 19, these men gave their hands in pledge to put away their wives, and for their guilt they each presented a ram from the flock as a guilt offering. So, an encouragement, they did obey this hard, radical, difficult call to obedience. Let me again remind us, it's not our call, but it was right for them at the time. But not only an encouragement, but there's a warning in these verses. Look down there in verse 23. Amongst all those lists we read, and among the Levites, and then a list of names. Among the Levites, and a list of names. Here is the warning. For amongst those who were discovered having foreign wives were some of the leaders of the community, these priests and Levites whose job it was to teach the law of God. And it seems to me this is here as a graphic warning to us, and I quote the words of Derek Kidner, that neither ancestry nor office is ever a guarantee of moral probity. The greatest danger we can ever face with respect to being unfaithful to God is to think that it can never happen to us. In his very helpful book, Rebuilding Your Broken World, Gordon MacDonald, a great Christian leader, covers all these themes, and I'd recommend you get a copy if you want to follow it through. But in this book, he writes of his own painful experience of rebuilding his own broken world. Listen to what he says here. He says, "For all the talk in the church about sin and misbehaviour, we probably do not take the matter of our vulnerability seriously enough. A few years ago, I gave a speech at a college commencement, and before the festivities began, a member of that school's board sat with me in the president's office. We'd never met before, and we were asking questions of each other that might help us get better acquainted. Suddenly, my new friend asked a strange question. I've thought about it many times since then. If Satan was to blow you out of the water, he asked, how do you think he'd do it? I'm not sure I know, I answered. All sorts of ways, I suppose, but I know there's one way he wouldn't get me. What's that? He'd never get me in the area of my personal relationships. That's one place where I've no doubt that I'm as strong as you can get." And he writes, "A few years after that conversation, my world broke wide open. A chain of seemingly innocent choices became destructive, and it was my fault. Choice by choice by choice, each easier to make, each becoming gradually darker, and then my world broke in the very area I had predicted I was safe, and my world had to be rebuilt." You see, the danger is for those of us in Christian leadership who have been Christians for a number of years, is so often it's in those areas where we think we are strong that we can easily become weak. We need to be aware. So let me conclude. The call to take courage, the call to decide, the call to investigate clearly. Now, as I said at the very beginning, one of the lessons of this chapter for us is the reminder that obedience to God is not an easy thing. It never is. And this is particularly so if we're somebody here today who knows that we have disobeyed God, who knows that we need to do something about it, but somehow we find it hard to do it. As someone has said, it's always easier to depart from God than to return to him. But let me give you some help. this passage speaks hope to us. For what Ezra tells the people to do is exactly what God would call us to do if we're stuck in the situation where, through our own fault and disobedience and sinfulness, our world has fallen apart. Ezra tells the people to make confession to the Lord, the God of your fathers, and do his will. That is, he tells them to do three things. Be honest to God about your sin, take hold of the hope you have in the Lord, and put right the wrong. And that's what we're called to do if we're in the situation of our own brokenness. Be honest to God. Just as Ezra needed to rebuild his broken nation on a solid foundation of truth, so we do too. Some scaffolding, a bit of redecoration, will not do. It's like trying to stick a bit of plaster over a wound. It might conceal it, but it will never ultimately heal it. We need to be honest with God, to call the sin as it is, confess to him, perhaps to some trusted friends if we need their support, but say it as it is. Be honest to God. Secondly, we need to take hold of the hope. Ezra calls the people here not to confess their sin into thin air, but to confess it to the Lord, the God of your fathers. We have a God who is faithful, who has kept the promise to the fathers in the Old Testament and the New, and is a faith, will be faithful to us. Remember the promise of 1 John. If we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves, the truth is not in us. But if we confess our sin, God is faithful and just. He will forgive us our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness. Be honest to God, take hold of the hope, and thirdly, put right the wrong. Make the tough decisions that will restore your relationship with God and maybe others who have somehow gotten involved in the sin. It might be we need to break up a relationship that is causing us to go astray, to own up to a deception that we've been perpetrating, to repay that money which we have wrongfully gained. Obedience is never an easy call, but it is the only way. Remember Jesus' words, "If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. It is better to go into heaven with one eye than into hell with two." Let's bow our heads in prayer. The call to us today is to be people of courage, to make courageous decisions. Some of us here today as leaders may need to take courageous decisions at work or with friends to confront difficult issues. And some of us today need to take courage to put right the wrongs in our life with God and with people that we have hurt. So let's just take a moment to bring ourselves before the Lord. And let me conclude with a favourite prayer of mine that asks the Lord to strengthen us, to change us, and to shape us for his purposes. Our prayer. Master Carpenter of Nazareth, who with the lathe and plane fashioned instruments of wood for your service and use, wield well your tools in our lives, that we who are broken and torn by the ravages of sin may become by you shaped into the people you want us to be, fit and ready to serve you and glorify you forever. For your name's sake we pray. Amen.